Langdon still felt shaky as he and Sophie came in from the rain and entered the King's College Library. The primary research room was a dramatic octagonal chamber dominated by an enormous round table, around which King Arthur and his knights might have been comfortable, were it not for the presence of 12 flat-screen computer workstations. On the far side of the room, a reference librarian was just settling in for her day of work.
"Lovely morning,"
she said in a cheerful British accent as she walked over, a pleasant look of recognition on her face.
"May I help you?"
"Thank you, yes," Langdon replied. "My name is..."
"Robert Langdon," she smiled. "I know who you are."
Of course, if anyone on Earth were going to recognize his face, it would be a librarian in a religious reference facility.
"Pamela Gettam,"
the librarian said, offering her hand. "A pleasure," Langdon said. "This is my friend, Sophie Neveu." The two women greeted one another, and Gettam turned immediately back to Langdon.
"I didn't know you were coming."
Langdon shook his head. "I'm afraid we've come unannounced. A friend of mine speaks very highly of you. Sir Lee Teabing?" Gettam laughed.
"Heavens, yes, what a character. Fanatical. Every time he comes in, it's always the same search strings. Grail, grail, grail. I swear that man will die before he gives up on that quest."
She winked.
"Now, what did you have in mind?"
"We're trying to find a tomb in London." Gettam looked dubious.
"We've got about 20,000 of them. Can you be a little more specific?"
"It's the tomb of a knight. We don't have a name."
"A knight? That tightens the net substantially." "We don't have much information about the knight we're looking for," Sophie said. "But this is what we know."
She produced a slip of paper on which she had written the first two lines of the poem. Puzzled, Gettam put on her glasses and examined the paper they had just handed her.
"In London lies a knight, a pope interred, his labor's fruit a holy wrath incurred."
She glanced at her guests.
"What is this? Some kind of Harvard scavenger hunt?"
Langdon's laugh sounded forced. "Yeah, something like that." Gettam pondered the verse carefully.
"According to this rhyme, a knight did something that incurred displeasure with God, and yet a pope was kind enough to bury him in London."
Langdon nodded. "Does it ring any bells?"
"Not offhand, but let's see what we can pull up in the database."
Gettam moved toward one of the workstations and sat down.
"Let's run a straight Boolean with a few obvious keywords."
"Thank you," Langdon said. Gettam typed in London, Knight, Pope, Tomb, and clicked the search button. London's Opus Dei Center is a modest brick building at 5 Orme Court, overlooking the North Walk at Kensington Gardens. Silas had never been here before, but he felt a rising sense of refuge and asylum as he approached the building on foot. Moving across a small courtyard to the front door, Silas was not surprised to find the door unlocked. He opened it and stepped into the minimalist foyer. A muted electronic chime sounded upstairs as Silas stepped onto the carpet. A man in a cloak came downstairs.
"May I help you?"
He had kind eyes that seemed not even to register Silas's startling physical appearance, although they did note his cloak.
"You look cold. You are a brother, I see."
"My name is Silas," he said, nodding.
"American?"
"Yes, traveling. I am in town only for the day. Might I rest here?"
"You need not even ask. There are two empty rooms on the third floor. Shall I bring you some tea and bread?"
"Thank you."
Silas was famished. Silas went upstairs to a modest room with a window, where he took off his wet robe and knelt down to pray in his undergarments. He heard his host come up and lay a tray outside his door. Silas finished his prayers, ate his food, and lay down to sleep. Three stories below, a phone was ringing. The Opus Dei prelate who had served Silas tea answered the line.
"This is the London police," the caller said. "We are trying to find an albino monk. We've had a tip-off that he might be there. Have you seen him?"
The prelate was startled.
"Yes, he is here."
"He is there now?"
"Yes, upstairs, praying."
"What is going on?"
"Leave him precisely where he is," the officer commanded. "Don't say a word to anyone. I'm sending officers over right away."
St. James's Park is a vast expanse of rolling lawns whose sweeping boundaries are marked by three palaces, Westminster, Buckingham, and James's Palace. Gazing across the sloping lawns, the teacher could see the spires of the building that housed the knight's tomb, the real reason he had told Remy to come to this spot.
As the teacher approached the front passenger door of the parked limousine, Remy leaned across and opened the door. The teacher paused outside, taking a pull from the flask of cognac he was carrying. Then he slid in beside Remy and closed the door. Remy held up the keystone like a trophy.
"You have done well," the teacher said.
"We have done well," Remy replied, laying the keystone in the teacher's eager hands. The teacher took another drink of cognac and handed the flask to Remy.
"Let's toast our success. The end is near."
Remy accepted the bottle gratefully. The cognac tasted salty, but Remy didn't care. He and the teacher were truly partners now. He could feel himself ascending to a higher station in life. Taking another swig from the flask, Remy could feel the cognac warming his blood. The warmth in Remy's throat, however, mutated quickly to an uncomfortable heat. Remy handed the flask back to the teacher.
"I've probably had enough," he managed, weakly.
Taking the flask, the teacher said,
"Remy, as you are aware, you are the only one who knows my face. I placed enormous trust in you."
"Yes," he said, feeling feverish, "and your identity shall go with me to the grave."
The teacher was silent a long moment.
"I believe you."
Pocketing the flask and the keystone, the teacher reached for the glove box and pulled out the tiny Medusa revolver. For an instant, Remy felt a surge of fear, but the teacher simply slipped it in his trousers pocket. Remy felt himself sweating suddenly.
"I know I promised you freedom," the teacher said. "But considering your circumstances, this is the best I can do."
The swelling in Remy's throat came on like an earthquake, and he lurched against the steering column, grabbing his throat and tasting vomit in his narrowing esophagus. He let out a muted croak of a scream, not even loud enough to be heard outside the car. The saltiness in the cognac now registered.
"I'm being murdered."
Remy tried to lift his clenched fists to blow the horn, but instead he slipped sideways, rolling onto the seat, lying on his side beside the teacher, clutching at his throat. Remy could no longer see, but he could sense his oxygen-deprived brain straining to cling to his last faint shreds of lucidity. As his world slowly went black, Remy Legaludec could have sworn he heard the sounds of the soft Riviera surf.